Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Reel 23. Now, I just want to, I know we've mentioned Pierre Costerman, a lieutenant, I presume, or sub-lieutenant, what was he like? Because his book is quite well known, and we've just been looking at it, in fact, he says it was him flying with you. He does say you shot it down, but he says it was him flying with you. What was he like? Tell us a bit more about, I didn't realise quite how famous he was.
He was a fairly tall guy, jet black hair. His photographs show him as he was in 1943, as I remember. But he came to the squadron from Biggin Hill, he was an outstanding flyer, there's no doubt about that. Very, very aloof, very, I suppose, self-opinionated at them. But at that time, we didn't know much about him, but he'd put up a bit of a black at Biggin Hill and was posted.
Now, what had he done? Did you know what he'd done?
Well, I it's only hearsay, but I think he lost his number one. And that was a crime in the annals of fighter command to lose your number one. I'm not sure whether that's
well, he was covering someone's tail and lost.
Yeah, that's I think that was what the. But he came and joined our squadron as a sergeant then. Yeah, he was a sergeant. Well, or the equivalent. He was non-commissioned rank to start with anyway. He and Jacques Remlinger, I think Jacques was already there, and the captain Aubertin, who was the. His French, all free French. But Costerman was really outstanding. He had strong views and he put his point across, and he could make the Spitfire literally talk. Any flying demonstrations, Costerman did it. He was brilliant, to say the least. And as he went round the squadron, he liked to operate on his own, particularly with his colleague. They were always off on rhubarbs, that's low-level attacks, when the weather was bad. He was tended to be a bit of an individualist. But as far as aerobatics and flying was concerned, there was nobody could touch him, really. He was...
And his book, what purport... I mean, you've made it clear you don't believe all his book, you know, but what most of his book was true, you seem to be saying.
Oh, yes. He used his author's license to the fullest subsequently, obviously. I mean, when he was with the squadron, he went round the squadron with a little blue RAF notebook writing down all sorts of things that were happening. And when we asked him about this, he said he was going to write a book after a war, which is fair. And the Big Show was the end product. Now, the contents of the Big Show, I can vouch for a good first half of that is pretty authentic. There might be a bit of author's license here and there, but on the main, the story's correct. And his subsequent issue of The Big Show, the second issue, which is more about himself, I have changed my opinion of him a bit, because he must have been when you read the second book, apart from his author's license, I'm sure it's fairly authentic, but he certainly... had a one-man war going there. He was really outstanding.
Was he popular?
I changed my opinion, but he seems quite... I met him once after the war, about 9 years after the war, and he was very pleased to see me as an individual. He was signing his book in Selfridges or something, and he was immaculately turned out. I was in a navy blue suit and red carnation, sitting at this great big desk signing all these books. And I hailed him from the end of the entrance to this high closet, we used to call him, and he stood up and he beamed. I hadn't seen him for about 9 years. He beamed all over, and we sat down and had a long chat, and I told him point blank I wasn't buying his book, but he did give me a copy. But his great gripe then was, that was 9 years after the war, that he was such a very bemedaled individual that when he did his reserve flying training, all the young pilots used to look at them and wonder who this doddering old man was. And he's asked for jets. He didn't have any time for jets then. They were no sooner up in the air than they had to get down again, literally. But, that was the last time I saw him. And I've written to him a number of times, about five or six times, but I never got a reply back. I even wrote to him about...
He's still alive then?
6 months ago. care of the author. When the author, when that new book came out, I wrote care of the publisher, and they rang me and said they'd sent the letter on, and so, but he's never replied. But yeah, it's unfortunate, but great guy, really brilliant flyer.
Now, anything else? I mean, this incident on the 20th of February, you shot down the it was an M, what sort of aircraft was it? I've got it down.
It's a 109.
109.
It was carrying long range tanks.
Right, that's what I was just checking.
Doing photo reconnaissance of Scapa Flow. That was the intention, but it didn't get there. I got the combat, the German combat report. I've got that in my records. And the pilot was 29 years of age, and he'd come from, I've got all the detail, what aircraft he was flying and so on and so forth. It was made it quite interesting reading when I had it translated into English. You know, a great voluminous form about A5 size, you know, ruled in numerous columns, and just the information the Germans wanted from the administrators was incredible.
So he survived?
No, he didn't survive.
No, he was
killed,
right?
Missing, killed. Yeah. Right, yeah. No, it's just one of these things. I just was curious.
Now, so anything else happened? What's the next thing that happened? You said, I think you said off tape that that was about the end of your
Yeah,
time
that was
we did
the usual patrols, but then the squadron moved back to Detling, and then from Detling it moved to. It only went back on the 10th, and on the 13th of March they moved to Llanbedr in North Wales.
Now, how and do you spell this was that? Sorry, Llan.
Llanbedr, Llanbedr. I don't think it's Llanbedr. Armament practice camp.
And that was training then, was it?
Oh, it's still training. What we were gone to Llanbedr for was to convert from a fighter role to a dive bomber role.
Now tell me about that, because that is interesting.
I just kept my glasses. Yeah, it was. They were going to teach us the art, inverted commas, of dive bombing with a fighter aircraft, particularly a Spitfire. But
now, how did that go?
I mean, not very well.
What were the problems?
It's a dog's dinner, really. To get a decent dive, a vertical dive in a Spitfire, is very difficult to get a vertical dive that away, straight down. We used to get about a 60-degree dive if we were lucky. And the only sighting arrangement was, in fact, the ring and bead sight, which you'd normally use if you're firing your gun. So the object of the exercise was to dive from a great height and get the bead on the target. And as you pull out of the dive, count 1, 2, 3, and then release the bomb, which was the theory behind it. And that was what we did. Now, I just noticed that my...
Now, this was in, what, March you were at Llanbedr, was it?
This is March. Yeah. Llanbedr, yes, March. It's still a Spitfire 5B. 9B. And we were doing things like air-to-ground firing, dive bombing and strafing. And that type of work, shallow dive bombing, and squadron bombing. They're all part of the work up to certain tactical aircraft close support. And see, some of the average dive bombing was 41 yards, 191 yards, average 40 yards. But my course report says total hours, 6 hours, 15 minutes. Dive bombing sorties, 3. Error, average 116 yards. Air to ground, average hits, percentage hits, 16.87%. And we fired off 41 feet of film. And the assessment says... no comments for as air firing or cine film. Dive bombing, below average. and low attack above average. So that was the assessment that I got when I left the course, so-called, on the 20th of March. And we moved back, the squadron moved back to Detling. No, well, we moved back to Detling.
So that's at the end of March.
Yeah, March 44. We carried on then, when we got back to Detling, with escort cover, three or four trips, squadron formations, close escort. We did one exercise in close escort, and then we did a practice dive bombing exercise. That was to, that brought us to the end of March. Come April, we were doing the same sort of thing. Exercise Jim Crow, I don't know what that was. It was an attack on a convoy of some description, attacking gun positions.
But you don't remember that?
Pardon?
You don't remember those?
No, I don't even remember that. Must have been a... Must have been a... Exercise Jim Crow must have been in this country, I don't think. Low-level cross-country again. We went to close escort, believe it or not, with marauders again. Charleroi, Brussels area. Charleroi twice, actually. Squadron, and then on the 13th of April, we did a dive bombing attack carrying 500-pound bombs on a no-ball target. That was one of these rocket sites.
Oh, what do you remember of that?
Pardon?
What do you remember about that?
Oh, it was, it says in the logbook, direct hits. Don't forget, there's a whole squadron on this, the 12 aircraft, and no flak, it says, and it was, quite a thing, actually.
What do you remember of it? Where was the rocket site? Pardon? Where was the rocket site?
Oh, I don't know where it was. Somewhere in the Pas de Calais area. It just says Noble Pas de Calais. It doesn't actually say, but we'd be in the Pas de Calais area.
And what happened? What do you remember? It was your first dive bomb, real raid.
Well, I remember that the squadron was up a long way up, actually. It must have been about 15,000 feet. And the brief was that when we got over the target in the normal finger formation of the squadron, they would form up in bombing formation, which was in the flights were then in echelon starboard, that's to say, echelon starboard to the right, and they were flights were spaced at 500 feet intervals, and the theory was that as the leader approached, to tuck the target down in the cannon, the port cannon. And when it disappeared under the leading edge, you would roll over and everybody would follow him down. That was the theory. And that's exactly what we did. And it seems to be been quite effective because there was no flag.
Did you hit the target or would you not know?
Well, it says direct hits, it says in my logbook. Don't forget there was 12...
So you wouldn't know if it was you or one of the others?
Oh, no. Don't forget, these no-ball targets were literally a concrete hut which was about 10 feet square and a ski rig, you know. As long as the bombs fell somewhere in the close proximity, then as far as we were concerned, it was a good exercise because whatever happened, it must have caused a little bit of aggravation. So that was it. And then we had another one. Next day, actually, same type of thing. It says no ball number 78. It doesn't say where it is, but it says flak very good, not healthy. And I was last man down. Results were quite good, but it was an effort. Terrible.
And that was, again, a raid on a rocket site.
Yeah, that's where these no balls were. V1 sites, isn't it? And... But it was very hairy because as time progressed, the Germans were able to cone their rocket sites by heavy flak, and you were getting heavy flak firing horizontally, almost, or low angles and you were getting heavy flak all from almost from ground level upwards to 8 to 10,000 feet, and it's not a healthy place to be. And we lost one or two aeroplanes, but that was the end of my tour actually. By the time I got to Ebert, I did a couple more of these no-ball attacks, and then I was posted.
Detling was your last station with them.
Yeah, Ford.
When did you move to Ford?
We moved to Ford on the 14th of April.
Where's Ford?
Tangmere. No, Ford, next Sussex. Near Chichester? Is it Chichester?
So you'd moved there early April, so that's where you flew these last missions from.
And we flew there from the 14th, yeah. The beauty of flying from there was you could get four aircraft on the runway at one time taking off. Across the runway. You were running in the ditch, mind you, but...
It was another makeshift airfield. But
no, Ford was proper...
That's a proper
runway.
Right.
But they... By taking off with a bomber on board and four abreast, which is a finger four, or the equivalent, outside men were running in the... running in the ditches, in the gutters, literally. But you could just keep the wheels on the edge. But it was better. The only thing was if an engine cut with a bomb on board, you would just have a slithering to a standstill. It happened one guy, he wasn't carrying a bomb, but engine cut taken off, and it was one of these, at Bognor Regis, and he just folded his wheels up and ploughed up the track in like a tin opener and came to rest in the intersection. It was just as well he was the last flight off, because it gave him an hour and a half to repair it, which they did.
Now, how your tour came to an end? Not the squadron tour, but your tour came to an end then, did it?
My tour, yeah. I must have clocked up the 11 hours, actually. Because I left them on that week of D-Day, April the 25th, and D-Day was... D-Day was May, wasn't it?
June 6th.
Yeah. I don't know. That was the last trip I did anyway. Just let me see when I was posted. It was very close to the end of the month. I don't know why. That was the date. That was the last trip. Oh, that's the photograph of the writing on the wall I was telling you about. I knew I had one somewhere. Ford. 25th of May, I was posted to... I've got down here non-effective sick. I don't know why that was. And then I went to 16 personnel. Something other way. Anyway, that was my tour. So as far as...
Were you pleased, you know... The tour was over. Did you want to go on to D-Day?
Well, the point...
In a way, you'd not gone overseas with them.
No, the point was, I'm just looking at this here. I'd completed 330 hours on Spitfire time. And that was, most of that, well, by a couple of hundred, that must have been operational time at least. I don't know how they did it.
I mean, I was going to ask. The bomber crews had a certain number of active service missions, 30 or
whatever. Yeah, well,
is it done with you Spitfire pilots? Or do you not know?
Well, I do know, because I did some figures. I think I did 61 missions, I think. 61. I'm just penciled them in as a matter of... interest, I see.
So it was a lot more than the bomber.
Yeah, but there was shorter duration. You've got to bear in mind the duration of our 50. I think it must have been 61, I think. Looks like 60. 61 I did.
Now, what was your next posting then?
I went from there. I had done Spitfire time. 111 hours, that doesn't seem very much. That must have been operational time for April 11.
That's just April.
It must have been on a time basis, because I'd been with the squad in 18 months, and I think we were looking for fresh guys to go across the other side. I was a little bit disappointed because we had all done all this work up, you know, all this escorts and stuff over the other side, and never got the opportunity to take the fight across the channel, being young and foolish, I suppose. I did feel a bit miffed. I felt I could have soldiered on and seen D-Day out, but that wasn't to be.
Now, what were you posted to then?
I was posted then to DRAM, I think. Was there a UT armament, I think?
Now, what's a UT armament?
Under-training armament officer. Well, about this time, I must, somewhere along the line, it must have figured out that I was going on an armament course, and this was preparation, I suppose, giving me the armament duties. DRAM, 12-6.
Where is DRAM?
DRAM?
DRAM.
It's about 10 miles to the east of Edinburgh, 10 or 15 miles east.
So Lothian,
yeah. It's the origin of the DRAM lighting system. Did you know that? Yeah, you probably didn't, did you? Yeah, it's a famous, it's near Turnhouse, actually. Turnhouse, you must know where the airport is. Yeah. Anyway, I went off there on 12th of June, it says here, 44. That was the week after D-Day. I remember sitting in this reception centre somewhere near Fine Training Command with Bognor Regis, sort of watching the invasion force going up. Never seen anything like it in my life. All the heavies going over on 5th of June, the evening of the 5th of June. All these gliders being towed, all the lights on, you know, and there was hundreds of, from eye to eye, all these heavy bombers going and the aircraft towing gliders all heading for the other side. Pretty obviously what was happening.
Now, what happened when you got to RAF Drum? You were an armaments officer under training.
Well, that was, yeah.
What training did you
have? Well, I went to the army. I was posted to the army, and I was doing what armament officers do, you know, odd things with the armory because of my background, I suppose. But I also did a bit of flying there. I did, because I was, I did 24 hours flying, actually.
Flying what?
Osters and martinets and masters.
So I was... Just for practice?
To keep my hand in. Yeah. Mainly flying, the officers were flying the air training corps, circus and
now,
dumps.
What were your duties as an armaments officer then? I mean, because, you know, I mean, we've talked about your duties when you were an armament, you know, when you were an armaments NCO
or
trainee.
You're responsible for the maintenance and the storage and the movement of explosives and weapons. And when I got to DRAM, it was just a station headquarters armory, and all you were responsible was for the pyrotechnics and the flying control center, practice bombing if any, air firing if there was any. But DRAM at that time was a naval air station, so my job there was really not very exciting, so therefore I could devote my time to a bit of flying. But it was following that the DRAM was quite interesting, but I was flying at the weekends and so on and so forth. So
how long were you there for?
DRAM, not long. DRAM, from the 12th of the 6th. Oh, 6 months. 12th of the 6th.
Yeah, January it says here, yeah.
Hmm?
Till January it says here.
Yeah, 4th of the 1st, 45. That's right. Then I went to Henlow from there. That was the start of my long armament course. Henlow for 3 months. That's for 2 months. Where we were, Henlow, that's in Bedfordshire, where we learned the basic skills of filing, turning, metalwork, machine operation, and things like that, all relative. I was a flying officer then, I think.
Was there much new compared to what? I mean, you've done so much armament training, had so much practical skill before the war.
No, it wasn't anything new. principles were the same, their weapons were different. I mean, we had bigger and better weapons, because when I was doing my armament, the biggest bomb we had was a 120-pounder, probably a 500-pounder. But the principles are the same. It didn't make any difference how big they were. But that was Henlow. That was the physical engineering of the armament trays, how to weld and how to whip brain them. And then I was posted to Manby in March '45.
Now, what was at Manby?
It's the Empire Air Armament Training School. And that was a monumental establishment. They trained armament officers from all walks of life. And it was a year's course.
A whole year?
Including the, I didn't leave Manby until August. Yeah, and I'd done 3 months before. Yeah, that's right. It was a long course.
Oh, so the course lasted a year, but it was at different places. So
yeah, it started at, it was 3 months. 3 months at Henlow, and then we moved on to Manby, and we left Manby, and it was just after the war finished, didn't it? For a week somewhere.
Now, what was going on at Manby then?
Well, Manby was the actual nitty-gritty. It's the nuts and bolts, the theory, the nuts and bolts, and the flying aspect of the armament course. The last 3 months of the armament course at Manby, you were applying theory into practice. In other words, you were flying in the... I'll just tell you what it was, actually. I did 20 hours flying on that course on Wellingtons and on a Lancaster, believe it or not.
What did you think? I mean, that would be your first time up in them, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was great. We were doing air firing from the front turrets, the rear turrets, and the top turrets. Really, and we were doing... bombing from the bomber's position, things like that, and
what did you think of the Wellington first and the Lancaster?
Well, the Wellington, yeah, it was just another big aircraft. It was a Wellington 10, actually. Oh, I see, there's a 14 here as well, but it was self and three passengers. They're bombing. It was great because we did cine camera gun and bombing and air firing and. Yeah, I enjoyed it very much. The one thing I wanted to do was to the training was overtaking the drogue, wind finding for bombing, range estimation. That's using a target to get practical experience and use of the turrets and bomb sites and the use of a Mark III low-level bomb. So that's all part of, this is all the theory that we've had been drummed into us and the mathematics that had been, God, when I think back. Curve of pursuit, which is the approach path that the hostile aircraft takes when it attacks, and quarter crossovers, that's when the aircraft attacks. I've got it summarized here. But 20 hours.
Now, so it was while you were there, firstly there was VE Day, and then there was VJ Day. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Well, VE Day, or were there any special celebrations, or for you, or?
No, I don't remember. I don't remember it really, apart from the fact that it happened. We must have been on ground instruction at that period because the flying didn't start till the 24th. So, I just remember it happening.
How did you feel about the end of the war? Any particular feelings, or?
I suppose I felt a great sigh of relief, actually, that, you know, basically, didn't sort of register. I don't know. I hadn't contributed a great deal. I was there, but I mean, I was only there. It was just one of these things, you know, that you. You other guys had done much more, bomber command people. What I did remember.